Well, greetings, everyone that will be listening to this podcast. I want to present to you Dr. Dan Rumberger. He was an MC at the ICBC, the International Center for Biblical Counseling, biannual conferences that were held every 2 years in Sioux City in the 90s. It was on the these conferences were on the cutting edge of presenting spiritual warfare training, introducing people to fundamentals of dissociative identity disorder, which was called NPD. And so Dan is a licensed psychologist, has a PhD in psychology, wonderful Christian man. Laura and I have spent time with him personally on several occasions. He has his practice and ministry in Sioux City, Iowa, still. He's been closely connected with Dr. Mark Bubeck, who is the founder of Deeper Walk International. This particular recording that I'm going to be playing, it comes from a conference that Laura and I attended in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. It was back before multiple personality disorder had been redesignated as DID in 1994 by the American Psychiatric Association. So he does not use the term DID. So I'm assuming this was sometime in 1993, 1994 when we attended this conference. C. Fred Dickinson was there, former chair of the Moody Bible Institute, chair of theology. Excuse me. And so this particular message that he gives is a part of a series that he presented there in Gettysburg. I have one posted online now, which is very excellent. This one I just found recently. It gives a history of NPD and why this is so important for those that are working with formerly NPD, dissociative identity disorder, is that this is the oldest psychiatric diagnosis on record. It goes way back into the 1700s. Dr. Dan, as we call him affectionately, he gives a whole history of the disorder and a summary, that is, and why it has been so challenged and covered up. So this is a very excellent presentation. He's already been introduced by the MC at the conference in Gettysburg, so I'm just going to pick up as Dan comes to the platform, and you'll have the opportunity to hear this wonderful presentation by a really a stellar counselor, psychologist, but especially as a brother and believer in Christ.
Yeah, that's fine. And one could get a big head. Got to swallow my halls. You're going to get vapor action tonight. Another word for hot air, I guess. Okay. Ron mentioned whatever. I don't want it to block my notes here, Ron. Ron mentioned Jim... Ron mentioned Jim Conway as the one who... mentioned the book, Men in Midlife Crisis, that was written by Jim Conway a number of years ago, and some of you were familiar with it, where he talked about the convergence of factors that seems to create midlife crisis in men. And one of the things that you might note if you read that book a little critically, he's quite dogmatic. Every man is going to go through his midlife crisis. A few years ago, just a very few years ago, the same man, Jim Conway, gave an address at Biola University where he said that long after he wrote that book, where he seemed to have so many of the answers, he was still plagued with depression. He hated to get up every morning. He was angry. He would fly off the handle at the slightest thing. And whatever he had done on working on midlife crisis didn't seem to be the answer. You know what it was? He found out that he hadn't dealt with the pain of his past. And he wasn't willing to until later on, after he wrote the book, he started to finally get down to the basis of why he was such an angry man. He opened up the door to looking at the painful memories of his childhood. When we talk about dissociation and multiple personality disorder, we're talking about people who have very effectively been able to avoid dealing with their painful past. Ron mentioned just now that it's a fairly recent phenomenon in psychiatry. And some people say, well, you know, I really have a struggle with this. I of something at the motel today, and the gal behind the front desk made the copy for me, and she said, I three faces of Eve. That doesn't really happen, does it? Oh, yes, that really does happen. And she was just in awe, and I think many people are, that something as bizarre as having different personalities within the same body could ever exist. It really troubles some people, and many of us in the arena of spiritual warfare have made some assumptions about that, that this is the result of demonization. So where was all this? If this is such a big deal today, on all the talk shows, it gets to be almost nauseous. It's a sensational topic on Oprah and Donahue and those kinds of shows. If this is such a big deal now, how come it wasn't a big deal 20 years ago? Where was it? Well, I'm going to take you on a little walk through some of the history of this because I think it has some important lessons to teach us. Actually, dissociation, which is the defense mechanism that enables the development of multiple personality disorder, is one of the oldest observed psychiatric conditions. The earliest description of it that we have been able to find came in the 1600s, where there was a description of a woman who couldn't find her money and found out there was another personality inside her that stole it from her. Then later in the 1700s, we started to get more observations. I mean, modern psychiatry, whatever that is, was not founded yet. It wasn't even close. And here are people describing the phenomenon of dissociation and multiple personality disorder. In 1791, a man named Gmelin was a German. I'm probably killing that. Sorry, German Ron. There was a German man who described one of his, a woman he was working with, as having exchange personalities. She had a French personality and a German personality, and they were very different. One would speak French, one would speak German, and neither of them knew the other language. In the late 1700s, Benjamin Rush, one of the founders of our country, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, the chief surgeon of the American Continental Army during the Revolutionary War, and the author of the first American textbook on psychiatry, collected numerous case studies on dissociation and multiple personality disorder, although he didn't always call them that. He didn't call them that. And he postulated that there was a doubling of consciousness due to a disconnection between the left and the right hemispheres of the brain. He thought that there was a personality that must reside in one side of the brain and another one on the other side of the brain, and somehow there'd been a disconnection, so the two halves of the brain function independently. Well, that wasn't a correct formulation of why it would happen, but he was observing it. Numerous case studies. In the 1800s, we saw many more cases described. Usually they were in-depth individual case studies, sometimes volumes and volumes written on one person being investigated. In the late 1830s, a man named Despine in France treated an 11-year-old Swiss girl named Estelle. She was paralyzed. Estelle was a paralyzed girl, but every once in a while she would switch into an alter personality who could walk, loved to play in the snow, and couldn't stand to be in her mother's presence. The two alters had entirely different sets of behaviors, entirely different food preferences, entirely different relationship styles with people. It goes on to say that in Frank Putnam's book, The Diagnosis and Treatment of Multiple Personality Disorder, that this man was able to cure her through a variety of techniques of hydrotherapy, a And I don't know what he did with water. I don't think he dipped her in cold water, but maybe he did. He did various kinds of treatments that they were trying back then, and something with magnetism. And he chalked up the successful treatment to that. But the interesting note in all that is that as he was getting to know her, he developed a close rapport with her. A close rapport. He worked with her for years, and he became friends with her. Well, guess what happened? In the trust of that relationship, this little girl could start to connect some of the reasons for her having these different altered states of consciousness, and apparently there was an integration of some sort. It wasn't because of hydrotherapy, although I probably shouldn't judge him, but I kind of doubt it, don't you? In the late 1800s to about 1920, there was a period of incredible interest. Remember, we're talking about 100 years ago. Incredible interest in this whole phenomenon of dissociation and multiple personalities, especially in the United States and France. One man named Azam studied a woman named Phillida for 35 years and wrote volumes on his investigations with her. He published that study in 1887, and he described one personality that was very sickly and unable to get along well in life, and another personality that was outgoing and vivacious. The sickly one claimed to be the normal personality. So did the other one. The sickly one showed up pregnant one day and had no idea how that possibly could have happened. Well, a little later out pops the other personality and says, well, guess what? Now, here we see that for a long time there have been many, many cases through the centuries where people have developed child, adult, alter personalities residing within the same body, where there would be frequent switches from one personality to another. There would be the reliving of traumatic events with the cringing from the blows of the trauma, the complete what we call abreactive type of experience that we see today. About 1920 until 1970, which is when most of us were born and grew up, there was a profound decline in interest in this whole subject, almost to the point where it became non-existent. If you look at the textbooks that came out of psychiatry and psychology up until the mid-70s, really, you see almost no serious mention of this. Now, during those years, The Three Faces of Eve came out, which was a movie, but by and large, people who talked seriously about multiple personality were laughed at. They were laughed to scorn. The climate professionally for those in psychiatry became so hostile to the whole topic of MPD that nobody seemed to dare bring it up anymore. The papers that did try to describe the phenomenon became extremely defensive, where they would try to prove its existence rather than really developing an understanding of how it develops. And you know, it's real interesting that this happened, because during the same period of time, especially in the later years, psychiatry would embrace all kinds of new syndromes. Every new edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Diseases that came out would come up with new syndromes. People say, oh, yeah, I see that, and they diagnose it. But MPD, uh-uh. It just wasn't there. People didn't bother with it. It kind of sounds like a cover-up, almost. Orchestrated by who? Why were MPD and dissociation relegated to such an obscure position in the field when it had been one of the oldest known conditions and so prominent in the literature before any of these other disorders like schizophrenia became apparent in the literature? Well, let's think about it. There were several reasons. Some people, and this is going to sound familiar to you, many critics in those years, from 1920 to 1970, many critics of MPD said that it was created by the investigators, that the people investigating and counseling and working with the people that claim to have multiple personalities, that those clinicians and investigators were inserting those personalities, those alleged traumatic experiences into their minds. Now, it's true that many of these were using hypnosis as part of their investigations. But the point is that the accusations, the debunkers were already there a long time ago saying that, just as some of our Christian writers do, that multiple personalities don't really exist, and that the counselors, the psychologists, and the psychiatrists are putting these notions into people's heads. Then along came, in this climate of hostile reaction to MPD, papers that would be well known for their, people who wrote papers and the people who were well known in the field would attack violently the whole notion. Why was there such virulence against it? What's the big deal? Why would people accept all these other diagnoses and not this one? What is the deal? What's the cover-up? Along came Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis during this time. And a political change was going on in the professional climate. It no longer was politically correct to consider dissociation as the reason why memories became hidden. What happened was Freud lived in an era when the industrialization was exploding in Europe and America. And you know what the fancy machines used back then? They used hydraulics. That was the technology of the day, just like computers are today. And so guess what he used to describe how memories and traumatic events get pushed out of consciousness? He used an hydraulic metaphor, repression. You push down something that's unwanted, and up pops a symptom. That's how he viewed it. And somehow, in the way these things develop, and I wonder who else might have been involved, there was a disdaining of dissociation and an elevating of the notion of repression, so that those who believed in MPD once again were squeezed out of the political, the professional political limelight. At the same period of time, there was an increase in the diagnosis of schizophrenia. Now, what happens in schizophrenia is that you have many times voices in the head of the person. Well, people with MPD hear voices all the time. But as the number of cases of schizophrenia were diagnosed, more and more cases of schizophrenia, there were less and less cases of MPD diagnosed. So what was happening is that many of the people who were truly suffering from MPD were being diagnosed with schizophrenia. And this still happens today. A girl came into my office a couple years ago. She had been to one of the major Christian clinics that you would all know if I said the name. And there are a lot of good people at some of these clinics. I'm not knocking them down. But the point is that trained clinicians in the Christian field also make the error of sometimes diagnosing schizophrenia when it really should be MPD. This lady went in there and she started to talk about the voices in her head. Boing. What happens? You talk about voices in your head that are threatening you, and immediately she was labeled paranoid schizophrenic. And she was put on Thorazine-type medications. This gal was not schizophrenic. She didn't talk crazy. There's a different flavor to a schizophrenic. They don't make sense many times when they're in a schizophrenic episode. Their thinking becomes circumstantial. Well, I won't go into all that because it gets off the track, but just trust me, it's different. And so she was diagnosed with schizophrenia. In her case, it was not schizophrenia, which is largely a biologically based disorder. She had MPD, and these voices were her altered personalities and wicked spirits talking to her in the head. At the same time, you had the increase in the use of medication to treat psychiatric disorders. When Freud was doing his thing, they weren't using medication. But later on, medication and the biological medical model of treatment of these kinds of problems, of all psychiatric problems, came into the forefront. And so what happened? As psychiatrists were trained, and most of the established psychiatrists out there now were trained during this period, they would treat according to the medical model using medication. What do you do with medication? When you're a psychiatrist, you evaluate the person initially, and then there tends to be quick, short-lived medicine checks. And your patients come in for 15 minutes every so often. There is no deep rapport established. You only see your doctor every few weeks, every few months. And there's none of that rapport established that is absolutely critical to the development of the treatment of people with multiple personality disorder, because it takes a long time to develop trust for these people. Their boundaries have been so violated in so many horrible ways that it's a long time before they start to open up enough and trust you enough to tell you what has gone on. Their altered personalities will begin to reveal some of their secrets. And so all these factors were working together to create a climate where it seemed as if MPD was a brand new thing. Now, why did it start to show to have a resurgence since 1970, and especially in the 80s and now the 90s? Well, just briefly, what happened was one thing was the Vietnam War. Vietnam War created a syndrome called that was very prevalent among its veterans, called post-traumatic stress disorder. It wasn't a new phenomenon. Battle fatigue and such things had always been described for years. But with Vietnam, it somehow, the vets that were coming back were suffering a great deal from the flashbacks of battle traumas that they experienced. By the way, parenthetically, why that war? There's other reasons we can go into besides this one, but I want to share with you one reason why Vietnam was the way it was. A man named Dan Brophy was over in Vietnam a few years ago interviewing some of the Vietnamese who had fought against the Americans. He was part of an official delegation from the United States to with the purpose of normalizing relationships with Vietnam. In talking with some of the priests, the Buddhist priests, they were told that for years, not just with the Americans, but with all foreign soldiers on Vietnamese soil, that these priests every single day would call down curses against any foreign soldiers on their soil. And the curses were that they would become wandering, angry men unable to find peace for the rest of their lives. Now, this is coming from the Vietnamese. It's not coming from an American's notion of what went on. Well, in the context of all that, these people these clinicians that were seeing these Vietnam veterans were finding out that they had been able to block out of their minds some of the traumatic experiences, and they would relive them. At the same time, we have a rise in the awareness of the public on child abuse. And we have more and more children whose traumatic, abusive backgrounds are they're being accepted as really happening. You know, for so long, when children would complain of this, the adults wouldn't believe them. But now we have a climate where sometimes to a fault, the perpetrators of abuse can be identified. When I say to a fault, I simply mean that there's such an acceptance of it that sometimes in the context of children's rights, there are some violations of parental rights, and we all hear both sides of that story. In 1980, DSM-3 came out, and that made it official that MPD was finally a legitimate diagnosis. Well, all this to say, I think there was a cover-up. I think that that the enemy's involved. I think the church needs to be involved. I think that what we're seeing is that the traumas inflicted by evil people, those involved in Satanism and just involved in the heinous acts of child abuse, were able to be protected by a removal of MPD and dissociation from legitimate inquiry. Just think about it. If people are open to consider the reality of alter personalities who experience the attachment of demonic entities, might they not start to consider that their Western rationalistic world may not be adequate to explain some of the phenomena? And indeed, some of the secular counselors and other mental health professionals are coming to the place where they can say, I don't understand it, but there's something more. There's something more than just a psychological, psychiatric type of disorder here. There's something else going on. There's an evil that is present and has orchestrated some of this, and their worldviews don't really allow them to follow through with that. But the point is, more people are asking some of the right questions, and I don't think the enemy wants that. And so he continues to send out the debunkers who will say, this is ridiculous. These things don't really happen. If they really happened, then we would find more evidence for it. It's an interesting controversy, but I want to caution you folks not to get too caught up in it, because I think if we get too caught up in it, we're going to shrink back from being willing to face the issues at hand and to provide a healing environment within our churches where these people can get help. Let's talk something about dissociation now. As I said, dissociation is the basic defense mechanism upon which multiple personality disorder is based. Here's a definition, and we'll try not to get too technical with it. It involves two basic elements. One is a change in the person's sense of identity. We're talking about a definition of dissociation now. And if you have this, if you have your glossary in your folder, that is defined there briefly as given by Cheryl Knight and Joe Getzinger in their book. In that description, it says it's a process of separation from an event or an experience. But the official description of it is that it's a change in the person's identity and a disturbance in the person's memory for events that occur during the period of dissociation. What do you got there? Oh, thank you. So, first, you have a change in the sense of identity. There's an alteration in the person's sense of who they are, and there's a disturbance in their memory. Another thing is that it is virtually always associated with trauma, that dissociative disorders develop in response to traumatic events. When you think dissociation, let's make it real simple and clear. Think disconnection. When a terrible event happens, I disconnect from it because it's just too bad to handle. Let's say normally, if I experience something, I remember it. I can remember something, you know, something happened today. But what happens if there is a way for that member, that experience to get deflected from my memory, so it just leaves a hole? Let me give you an example of dissociation in my life. My earliest memory is as a 2-year-old standing by a train track with a speeding train going by. And my mother had taken me there to look at this train, because I loved trains. And she didn't realize how fast this train was going to go, and we were probably, you know, 4 feet from the track, and the suction of the train started to pull us toward the train. And my mother was scared to death, she tells me, and held me back. I can see that. It's my earliest memory. I can see it real clearly in my mind. But I can't recall being afraid. I can't recall any of the feelings, not one of them. In fact, my memory of it is really strange because I can see myself like an observer being held by my mom. Don't ask me how that operates. I really don't understand it. But I can see myself being held by her and her skirt billowing out and the train whizzing by. But I can't remember the feelings. But you know what? For a period of at least a couple years after that, I was deathly afraid of loud noises, of trains, of motorcycles, of my father's power saw. I would run away from it. I remember the terror that I felt in all those other experiences. But in that memory of that train, the emotion of it is dissociated. It's totally missing. It's like a hole. It's just not there. What's the difference between repression and dissociation? Consider this piece of paper to be a person, a person's life. And lo and behold, something traumatic happens to that person. Something in the nature, let's say, make it something real evil, like they are abused, a little child being sexually abused. Well, let's represent that by this black mark on the paper. Now this child's innocent life has been violated by this terrible evil event. In repression, which is what an older child would often use, or what you and I would use if we were overcome by it and couldn't deal with it. In repression, it would be like painting over that black mark, putting white out on it. And so we cover it up, and we say, oh, nothing happened, and we smile. Repression always goes along with denial. Nothing really happened. It's just not there. And there's this big coat of paint there, and through the years, eventually the paint starts to chip, and the bad stuff starts to show through. But the person who is repressed and uses denial says, no, it's not there. Everything was fine. Nothing happened. Daddy was good. In dissociation, the child, who is often younger when it first occurs, does something much more remarkable than that. He effectively takes the part of his mind that experienced that trauma and removes it. Instead of sweeping the dirt under the rug and putting a flower pot in the lump and saying, that's my flower stand, like the person who represses and denies, the person who dissociates takes that event, they put it in a steel drum, and they bury it in concrete in the basement. And it's like it's not there. It's like it didn't happen at all. And so the person can say, it didn't happen, and it's not because they're using denial. They really do not experience the effects of that trauma. It's like it never happened. Boom, it's gone. Gone, gone, gone. Out of mind. And they might say, well, if it happened, remember the woman in the 1600s? If somebody stole the money, I don't know who it certainly wasn't me. I did it. You know? That's what dissociation is like. It's a removal of it. Now what happens is, years later, the steel drum starts to leak. And so the dissociated events gradually start to come back into consciousness again, and you start to get symptoms that that bring the person into treatment. Consider something else, though. Let's say that the perpetrator of this sexual abuse, we'll call him Uncle Joe, let's say it wasn't a one-time event. Let's say it occurred over and over and over again. And the first time, the kid just forgot it, put it out of his mind. Well, guess what happens if it happens regularly? Let's say Uncle Joe is living with the family, babysits a lot. And every time Uncle Joe comes into the bedroom, the child knows something horrible is going to happen, but he doesn't want to know it. So guess what happens? Out comes that part of him that experienced that. See, when I tore this paper, I didn't just remove the black mark. I took the part of the paper that the black mark was written on, and I folded it under. And so what the dissociator does is he takes a part of his mind and separates it from the rest of his mind. And then when those traumatic events reoccur over and over again, and the person is not getting any help, the child's not getting any help from anywhere, or isn't able to tell anyone about it so he can get help, then every time that event happens, out comes that dissociated part of his mind. And that part receives more of that trauma and then goes back in. You see? And if they're undergoing a lot of that, you can have numerous black marks doing the same function. Because this part is only so big and it only contains so much trauma. And if that part reaches its limit for how much trauma it can contain, there's going to be another split, and yet another, and another. That's what dissociation does. It puts the traumatic event out of the mind of the person almost instantaneously. And generally, while it's happening, or once they know it's going to happen, it happens before it ever starts to occur again. So, when you think dissociation, think disconnecting. Disconnecting. The person disconnecting a part of their mind from the traumatic event. And as in my example, where I dissociated the emotions, but I remembered the event, there can be partial dissociations. Dissociation exists on a continuum where you can go from mild dissociation to major dissociation, such as an MPD. Mild dissociation is something that we all experience. We disconnect when we daydream, when we're doing something monotonous, when we're in a boring situation, or sometimes under trauma. You can't remember the accident. Now, there could be a physical part of that too, but it's such a common thing that when there is a blow to the head or something like that, the person forgets. There may be some sort of a physiological, psychological connection there that aids in the removal of that event from the person's mind. When you're driving down the highway and you suffer highway hypnosis and you can't remember what happened the last 10 miles, but you know you've been driving along, okay, that's a disconnecting. We're able to talk with the person sitting next to us in the car and still keep our attention, hopefully, on the road and drive defensively. And it functions to our benefit. It's very adaptive because it lets us do more than one thing at a time. The person who can do more than one thing at a time, like Doris Orban when she plays the piano, is seen as someone who's very talented. And it is. Normally, people who dissociate real easily are intelligent, creative individuals. As we go from that continuum of normal dissociation, we gradually get into situations where it becomes more dysfunctional, such as in post-traumatic stress disorder, where the events of a trauma, a specific trauma, perhaps even in adulthood, are put out of mind, or the person doesn't want to think about it, and yet the flashbacks come, and you get all the symptoms that describe that disorder. Some people are better dissociators than others. Some folks can't dissociate hardly at all, and others can dissociate at the drop of a hat. Some people have written about dissociative potential. Jim Friesen, in his book, talks quite a bit about that. And that is the capacity of the person to dissociate. When a person's tolerance for pain or traumatic experience is reached, when they can only take so much, no more, and their capacity to dissociate is large, as soon as those two things meet, there tends to be a dissociation. It can be a dissociating of the whole event, the memory of it, the cognitive part of it, the pictures, the imagery, the emotions, and the bodily sensations. They can all be dissociated out of mind, or any part of those can be dissociated. One of the events that you'll see in your counseling office sometimes is someone talking about terrible events that happened to them, but they're doing it with a flat affect, with no emotion, no sense of feeling. Well, I can talk about that train experience that way. The emotions of the event have been dissociated. There's also something that you'll hear about that maybe some of you have said, oh, that's crazy, that's nuts, called body memory. I don't understand the mechanism of it. People talk about events stored in the body. I think it's in the brain, where all sensation is interpreted. The bodily sensations of an event can be dissociated, so that when a person is recalling memories for the first time, especially, they will actually feel the physical sensations almost to the point, and sometimes to the point of having things like bruises show up on their bodies. I have not personally run into that yet, but I know it does occur. So that's the phenomenon of dissociation. Think also of a battleship, maybe a submarine. You know how a ship is designed with different compartments that you can seal off? Well, what's the purpose of those different compartments? It's so that if the ship is punctured by a torpedo or by an iceberg or whatever, that the whole ship won't go down. You can seal off that part of the ship and contain the flooding of it within that section. And it'll affect the boat will list, but it won't sink because you've been able to contain the damage. Similarly, in the mind of the dissociator, that traumatic event that is so toxic that it would just overwhelm them, it's held off. It's a marvelous, God-given defense mechanism that enables children to survive. The wall that separates these traumatic memories from their conscious mind does them a great service because it enables them to survive. It enables them to continue functioning normally, to have parts of them that can relate to parents. I have people. Well, we talked about some today earlier, where you had some kids that were raised in a good Christian home, but they were regularly, ritually abused by a babysitter. We see frequent cases of that. These children are able to continue to appear totally normal and have good positive relationships with the outside world and thus develop normally, relatively speaking, normally, rather than being devastated by the trauma. Children who can't do that develop much more serious disorders, such as the borderline personality. A severe borderline is much more difficult to deal with because they're so flooded by their emotions and they're just not able to have normal relationship with people. However, the same wall that protects them also blocks access of truth to that part of their experience. And those of us who have been involved in spiritual warfare and a desire to set people free know that in order to set a person free from bondage to the enemy, that you've got to deal with the legal ground that the enemy holds. And if the enemy is holding ground in dissociated memories, you're not going to be able to get the person free unless you can reconnect that person with those events. They can't renounce them if they can't remember them. For those of you who have read some of Neil Anderson's books, like The Bondage Breaker, which have done a wonderful service to all of us, he has realized since writing that book that it's not a simple matter of having a person renounce all the potential satanic events and have them come to freedom. Because if there are blocked off portions of the personality that aren't involved in that renunciation, it's not going to do any good. And so when you see people in your offices, in your churches and elsewhere, who are coming to you with some of the signs of dissociation and multiplicity, which we can talk about tomorrow, it does no good to rush in there and try to get them to renounce things that maybe happened. You can do it. It may do some good. And who knows, I'm not going to limit the Holy Spirit's work, but by the same token, they're not going to be able to get free until they deal with the ground. And if that ground's hidden, as I said before, they've got to access those memories. In conclusion, I guess I would say one other point. Dissociation, though it is normal in the sense of it's a God-given defense mechanism that enables people to survive, becomes dysfunctional later on in life. It becomes dysfunctional because the person hasn't learned to use other coping skills, and we will jump into that and talk a little bit more tomorrow, but in view of the time, we need to quit.
Well, that concludes this particular lecture by Dr. Dan Rumberger, which I look forward to having posted on our website soon. And I will also have his link to his website as well. I think that will conclude this. I know that there are more lectures that he gave at that seminar. We have two posted. I wished we had all of them, but I do not know how to obtain them since it's been so far in the past, 1994, perhaps 1993, I'm not really sure. But anyway, I know that you who will listen to this will be greatly blessed. It's a tremendous presentation. He's a great presenter, and I greatly appreciate Dr. Dan Rumberger and his work and his diligence to work in this very difficult field. Blessings to all.